Welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program addressing the ramifications of change in our communities and beyond, and how today's choices will impact tomorrow's community. This program is a project of KCBX and its team of program hosts. And speaking of hosts, our host today, first show of the new year, is Dr. Mario Espinoza-Kulik. We invite you to listen, learn, and participate in the conversation today, Thursday, between 1 and 2. We're live, so you can join the conversation in and call at 805-781-3875, or you can email your questions after the program to voices@kcbx.org. With that, let's wish him a happy new year and say hi to Mario Espinoza-Kulik and his guest. Over to you, Mario.
Thanks, Brad. Happy New Year. Happy New Year, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to Central Coast Voices on KCBX. I'm your host, Dr. Mario Espinoza-Kulik, with your Central Coast listener-supported radio station. As we continue today with our show, I wanted to first give a few words and context. During World War II, more than 120,000 people of Japanese ancestry were forcibly removed from their homes and incarcerated under Executive Order 9066. Two-thirds of those imprisoned were U.S. citizens, many of them children. This historical reality is often referred to as internment or incarceration. Today, we will discuss with community leaders who are helping preserve and share these histories on the Central Coast through lived experience, scholarship, and artistic practice, including the upcoming multimedia commemoration titled Behind Barbed Wire Redux, A Glimpse at Central Coast Japanese American Life in World War II, on January 23rd, 2026, at the Clark Center in Arroyo Grande. Joining me for today's show, we have Dr. Dion Nielsen Price, composer, pianist, author, and Arroyo Grande resident. We also have Margaret Nakamura Cooper, retired Rigetti High School teacher in Santa Maria, and Dr. Brian Asher Alhadef, general and artistic director of Opera San Luis Obispo. Thank you all for joining us, and welcome to Central Coast Voices.
Thanks for having us.
Hi. Margaret. Thank you.
Thank you. I wanted to first start with you, Dr. Price. Do you want to please introduce yourself and share how your background as a composer and educator led you to engage with the history of Japanese American incarceration on the Central Coast?
Yes, I'd be glad to. You know, I have been called the composer queen of war music.
Yes.
A long time ago, I wrote a song based on a poem by a Bay Area poet, Carolyn Pearson. The song is called To All Women Everywhere. It is a lullaby to the heads of state. It says in the song, "You have forgotten the sound of your mother's voice. We do not hurt one another. Put the guns and the toys and the tanks back in the toy box. And let us sing them to peace." So the reason I mention that is because that song was recently performed and recorded by a well-known soprano from this area, Amy Gormirak, and pianist Susan Davies, and a flute player, Suzanne Duffy, who is going to be in our program on the 23rd, playing flute. And they performed it at Cal Poly with the whole song cycle. But in 2015, I was asked to write music about the Watts riots. In 1965, there was a 50-year commemoration of that awful time. And I was glad to do that because I had lived in the riot zone at that time. I'm also 91. And even before that, I wrote a series of songs called To the Children of War. I had been organist in a Methodist church where a group of youth who were refugees from Central America in the 1980s had an organization called Children of War, and I heard their stories. And so I wrote a song cycle based on poetry by Maya Angelou. And we're doing four of those songs in this program coming up that you mentioned, the Behind Barbed Wire Redux. Well, back to 2015, that was in the 1980s I wrote that. Then I wrote this for the Watts Rebellion. It was called Watts 1965, A Remembrance, My Remembrance. And I wrote it for Mary Au, commissioned it, a pianist, and saxophonist Chika Inoue, who performed that all over Southern California. And she really wails with her saxophone in the blues section of it. So in 2017, California State University at Dominguez Hills was planning the 75th commemoration of the signing of executive order that you mentioned, 1966, that put all the Japanese American families on the West Coast into incarceration camps. So I wrote a piece of music called Behind Barbed Wire, which told about life in the camps. It begins with bombing of Pearl Harbor and ends with the atomic bomb in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and in between tells about life in the camps. I wrote that for Mary and Chika Inoue, the saxophonist. They performed that in San Francisco, all over Southern California, and after they'd done it many times, the Media Arts Department at Cal State Dominguez Hills created a documentary video to go with it. And so now we often do it with the documentary. An orchestra in New York City commissioned me to orchestrate it. And so Chika has gone to New York. People on the East Coast didn't know anything about this story, what happened in California and the Western states. But we did a lot of research when in the Japanese American Museum in Los Angeles. And in our research, we found tanka and haiku poetry, which had been written by internees in the camps. So we've included that in with the music. I've got a couple of poems. I'll tell you one. One of the poems says, "Existing without barriers between rich and poor." Isn't it hot? Awfully hot? And another one, "Handcuffed and taken away, I see my husband even today."
Those are striking poems.
So then I moved to Arroyo Grande in 2020. And people here, some of my friends, had heard this work. And they said, well, you really should do it here because so many Japanese American families had their lives turned upside down. So I met Jim Gregory, local historian, who has a wonderful book on the history of Arroyo Grande area, and has a video called People of Honor about the Japanese Americans in the internment camps. We will be seeing that video, most of that video, on our program. Then I met Brian Asher Alhadef, and he was interested in the orchestra here playing it. So I reorchestrated it for a different set of instruments than we had in New York. And here we are. So we did it last year, and I think he's going to tell you about that. But I must say, when I left today, last time when we did it, it was sold out. Today, there are only 85 tickets left.
Oh, my goodness.
Did you know that?
Really?
When I left to come here, so it's going to be sold out again.
It's what I told you. This is a last-minute town. People decide when they want to do something the day they look at the every day when they look at their cell phones.
Yeah, I can attest to that. You know, yes.
I'm wondering right now whether I'm going to have lunch where I'm going to have lunch and what I'm going to eat. I have no idea what it's going to be.
Okay. Oh, congratulations. That's an amazing feat for the show. I'm excited to hear more about that.
Yeah.
Margaret, do you want to share more about your background with us?
Well, I'm a 95-year-old sansei. Now, sansei means 33rd generation, because my mother is a nisei. She's a second generation Japanese American. She was born in 1902 and died at age 107. But she married my father in 1921, and at that moment, the government took away her citizenship, even though she was born here. So she was a person without a country for 11 years. And the League of Women Voters was one of the organizations that helped rescind that order, and she became a citizen again.
So, Margaret, just so I understand for our listeners, too, your mother was born here in the United States?
She was born here in San Jose.
Oh, my goodness. In 1901?
1902. Yeah. And she didn't tell me that until she was 100 years old. She lived to be 107. And so I was in disbelief, because if she was born here, how could they take away her citizenship? Mm-hmm. But they did. And the League of Women and Voters was one of the organizations that helped rescind that order, and she later regained her citizenship.
And that was in 1925.
In 1921, when she got married to my father.
Uh-huh.
So, and my father came to this country in 1918, and they told him if he joined the army, he would gain citizenship, because most other Japanese Americans from Japan, or Japanese from Japan, were not able to get citizenship, naturalization. And it was only when he turned 61 that he was able to get his naturalization. And by that time, most of his life was gone. So within that, in his marriage, my mother had to take care of a lot of legal things like land ownership or things like that. And unfortunately, for my mother, he didn't have the usual male dominant type of personality, so he allowed her to take charge in certain legal matters, and so my mother sort of wore the pants in the family. And I do remember my childhood before World War II. It was during the Depression, and I was born in 1930, so it was right after the crash. And we were very poor.
And where were you born, Margaret?
I was born in San Jose.
Oh, San Jose.
Yeah, but our house was in Mountain View, because I was born in O'Connor Hospital in San Jose. But anyway, I do remember the Depression. We were quite poor. My father subleased a plot of land and grew raspberries, and he had a horse named Dick. Then, and the horse had a corral that was attached to the garage. So the car was in the garage, and the corral was attached to the car. So there are two modes of transportation, although the horse was an animal to pull the plow. And I remember that plow with a metal front. And so I do have a lot of memories of the old California, when there were a lot of farmers, but now Silicon Valley has replaced Mountain View, where I grew up, and my parents, after the war, bought a house for $10,000, And recently it sold for like $2 million because it was in the center of Silicon Valley.
Wow.
So that's kind of an amazing...
And then how did you get to the Central Coast?
Out of, well.
Or are you from, did we bring you here from San Jose?
Yeah. Well, what happened after, when my husband and I first married, we both were artists. We graduated with a degree in art and got a job at Disney Studios. And my husband was an animator on Sleeping Beauty and 101 Dalmatians, and I was an inker. And that was the beginning of being
a wild
able
romance.
To, no, of being able to reproduce, you know, exactly. But my job was to ink the animated lines, and it had to be very accurate. So it was not a creative job, but we met a lot of interesting people. And one of these people was a Norwegian named Bjørn Aronsen, and he invited us to go to Europe and start the first animation studio there, which we did, but not after we had bought a VW van. We saved enough money in 2 years. One of our salaries went into the bank, and in 1958, we took a steamship to Europe and drove this van around up and down Europe, looking at all the famous places and doing watercolors, because this is what we majored in. And we did a whole series of watercolors, Venice and Rome, and we lived a very sparse life, but very adventuresome. And my husband and I had a great time before children. And later on, when we had children, we had three sons. And
is that when you moved to Santa Maria?
Yeah. Well, we moved to Santa Maria when the animation business sort of had a bad time, and he decided he needed a job that was more secure. So luckily, we had both gotten secondary credentials. So he was lucky that he got a job at Santa Maria High, and we brought up our three kids in a teacherage. Now, the teacherage was a group of houses, nine houses that were lined up in a kind of a compound, and these were beginning teachers that were able to rent these houses, and they were California bungalows. We rented these houses for $35 a month, which was a real bargain even then, and included utilities. So we saved our money, and kids went to school. I stayed home and watched the kids. Fred taught at Santa Maria High. Our kids went to local schools, and all three sons went to Cal Poly, became engineers, and now they are all retired. So you know you're old when all three of your sons are retired.
Well, it sounds to me like since the war, when you came back, your life has been adventurous but very successful with those sons.
I would say so. And, you know, unlike other people of my situation, Japanese Americans, who are reluctant to talk about their incarceration, I am more than willing to talk about what happened to me, because I feel that it's important that people know what happened. And I don't want to embellish it in any way, but I do want people to know the truth.
And we'll hear more about that when we return. I'm Dr. Mario Espinoza-Kulik with you for Central Coast Voices on KCBX, your Central Coast listener-supported radio station. To join in and ask a question of our guests, you can call 805-781-3875 or email your questions to voices@kcbx.org. As we continue Central Coast Voices, our guests are Dr. Dion Nielsen-Price, composer, pianist, author, and a Rio Grande resident, Margaret Nakamura Cooper, retired Rigetti High School teacher in Santa Maria, and Dr. Brian Asher Alhadef, General and Artistic Director of Opera San Luis Obispo. So we were just talking about both Dr. Dion and Margaret and their backgrounds, and I still wanted to introduce you all to our third guest, Dr. Brian Asher Alhadef. You mind telling us a little bit more about yourself?
Well, I'm sort of just taken back by the presence of our guests here, as I'm sure you are, Mario. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're sort of like the newbies on the block, having grown up in the shadow of just the stories that Margaret is telling us and that Dion is writing music about. But most folks know me as the conductor of just about everything staged in the area. I'm the general director of Opera San Luis Obispo. I'm also the principal conductor of State Street Ballet, Ventura County Ballet, and Civic Ballet San Luis Obispo. And I'm also the artistic director and conductor of the Lompoc Pops Orchestra. I'll keep it short about me, but what I really enjoy about my career and what I would impart about to listeners is a very fun life is to bounce around in all these different genres. So, you know, just 2 weeks ago, I was doing a big pops concert at the PAC for our New Year's Eve celebration with Broadway and opera and symphonic music. And a week before, I was conducting the full ballet of Nutcracker in the Granada Theater. And then the week before that, it was, you know, all over the place and the Hansel and Gretel opera and Wizard of Oz grand production in when you were only 9 years old, the movie version of The Wizard of Oz. And so it's a wonderful career. And now I'm switching tracks again to focus on I gave the Central Coast premiere of Behind Barbed Wire last year at the Clark Center, which was a very successful sold out event. And it was so successful that the community has rallied together to mount a redux, the Redux. And one thing that we're learning about Behind Barbed Wire is that it is a very unique kind of music in the sense that it's a constantly evolving story and commemoration of this time period in our history. In the sense that when we did it last year, there were a certain number of people that came out to talk about their incarceration experience, to talk about their experience as children of incarcerated people. And this year, we have a different group of people that are – Margaret is brand new to us. She's come to our attention, and she's going to tell her story. So some of the music stays the same. Some of the music changes. This year, we'll be bringing soloist Catherine Loomis to the stage. And she comes from a family that's historically rooted in the incarceration here, in the sense that her family, the Loomis family, is a historic Central Coast family that owned farms and that cared for Japanese-American farms during their incarceration and returned them to Japanese-Americans when they came out of the incarceration. So that's just an amazing story. And the idea of Behind Barbed Wire is it's an amazing production that really is central to the history that we experience here as Central Coast inhabitants.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know. We've heard so much about families in the Central Coast that have strong connections to the incarceration camps, especially in San Luis Obispo and Rio Grande. And I'm sure in Behind Barbed Wire, through the performance that has music and narration, archival images, it's this sort of testimony to both the historical context and the community memory of incarceration. And I want to be very clear for our listeners that we're saying incarceration intentionally, because internment is just, I think, it does not do justice to the occurrences and violence that occurred. We've seen time and time again that language matters. And so for folks that are listening that may remember this event or have learned about this event as the quote-unquote internment, we are using incarceration intentionally here. And perhaps Dr. Price can walk us through, you know, what Behind Barbed Wire Redux is, and how does that differ from other similar projects?
Well, we know that in the incarceration camps, first let me say that we met with quite a few contacts that we made of Japanese Americans living in the Central Coast. And some of them said they would like to share their stories. Not all of them. And those who would like to share were in the program last year, and some of them will be telling them again this year. And then others will be new people like Margaret who are anxious to tell their story.
Yeah. Dion, what was the experience you had with the folks that didn't want to share their story? Did you get
That's a good question, because that leads into what I wanted to say about the program. One lady who was in the camps has a wonderful story to tell. She met her husband in the camps, and they were married there. They were both teenagers. She decided that she went back and forth. She decided that she did not want to share her story on this program because we were having a big band and we were having wonderful, lively music as well as sad music. And she said it was too sad of an experience for that. But the reason we have asked the Friendly Neighborhood Big Band to join with us on the stage is because in the camps, the people in the camps kept their spirits up through lots of sports, especially baseball, and music, all kinds of music. But there were a lot of high school students in the camps. And every Friday night, they would have a dance. And they were dancing to swing music of the 1940s.
Which was the soundtrack. So the big band is really the soundtrack of this time in history.
Yeah. Exactly.
And your music is more of the Greek tragic chorus of what's really happening behind the scenes
that's
of this
right.
soundtrack.
So that's with the orchestra that you're going to be conducting. Mm-hmm. And the big band is conducted by Mitch Ladding. And they give people who attended last year afterwards told me that they brought their whole family. It was a family I'm thinking of who have Japanese legacy in their family. And they said on the way home to San Francisco, they came down all the way to San Francisco to see it. Everybody in the car told what they liked about it, and they all liked a different thing. Someone liked the orchestra, some liked the vocal solos, some liked the dancers, some liked the big band. It was just made it a very interesting show, and they also said that it was a story they did not know before.
And we're going to take just a quick break, and we'll come back and hear back from Margaret about more about the context. Okay. We just need to hear from our team, and we'll be right back on Central Coast Voices.
Okay.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, we spend a Sunday with Mary Estrada while she visits her husband in prison, something she's been doing for 40 years. And we break down the financial and emotional costs for women who have a loved one in prison. That's next time on Latino USA.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Tessa Thompson. She stars as a former news anchor back in the public eye after a murder in the new Netflix series His and Hers. We'll also talk about her career, including her acclaimed turn as Hedda Gabler and why she's drawn to playing powerful, complicated women. Join us.
There are a lot of things in the economic world right now that are changing, like the tax code.
We can't solve our problems with a tax cut. We need to solve it with a tax reform.
It has to be a win-win-win-win-win, and that is very hard to achieve with tax policy.
This happens once in a generation.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll guide you through it next time on Marketplace.
That's a look ahead today on our Thursday on KCBX with Latino USA following this program up at 2 o'clock. Then Fresh Air comes at 3 and then Marketplace from 4 to 4:30. Right now, let's return to Mario Espinoza-Kulik and his guests on Central Coast Voices. Back to you, Mario.
Thanks, Brad. And hey, y'all, listeners, we have a just-in news break about our show today, and that's that we're able to give away two tickets to Barbed Wire, Behind Barbed Wire Redux today by calling 205-781-3875 and asking questions of our guests. To start us off, I want to start with Margaret. My understanding is that you were in junior high while you were incarcerated.
Yes, I was.
Would you like to share more about your experience?
Well, you know, the thing about my experience is that when I was told I'd have to go behind barbed wire with my family and 120,000 other mostly Americans of Japanese descent, it just hit me like a ton of bricks. Was I or was I not an American? I had never lived in Japan. I had no allegiance to Japan, and yet my country was telling me that I was the enemy. So that did a terrible thing to my self-esteem. And I think that lack of self-esteem is something that I suffer from even today. So, you know, at that time, after that time, I tried to recover by being twice as good as everyone else. I was the model student. I thought, well, by doing this, I will make up for my lack of value. So even today, I have moments when I feel inferior somehow. I know I'm not, but somehow emotionally, I feel this, and I feel that I can't speak up because maybe my views are not right.
Well, not to mention that just the your incarceration experience wasn't the only experience that your family endured.
No.
Your mother endured that.
Right.
Your father endured
right.
that. And it was like three strikes when the actual
exactly.
World War effects
exactly.
happened.
Exactly.
Yeah, there was already
yeah.
quite a lot of discrimination,
yeah.
even in this area
oh,
where
yes.
there were so many Japanese
yes.
who were living here.
And the Hearst newspapers also, you know, had articles about, you know, and cartoons about Japanese that with buck teeth and so forth. So, the whole image of the Japanese Americans was very bad, even before the incarceration. So it was not hard to convince people that we should put these people behind barbed wire.
So where were you when you found out about?
Well, I was eating spaghetti off of paper plates because this was right after Sunday school, and the organist invited us to her house. And when she opened the screen door and said, "The Japanese have bombed Pearl Harbor," as an 11-year-old, I thought, well, what does that have to do with me, you mm-hmm. know? But I could tell it was something very serious because Mary Kiyomura had this terrible look on her face, and I knew. And so, therefore, only 4 months later, in April, I was sent to Santa Anita Racetrack, and they kicked out the horses and put people in there instead.
Wow.
And so all during that time, and that was about a half a year, there were 14,000 of us behind barbed wire and living in stables or else tar paper barracks. We endured that for about half a year, and then later on, we were put on trains and not told where we were going. And we were 3 days on this train, and we ended up in Heart Mountain, Wyoming. Now, the contrast between Los Angeles and Wyoming was tremendous because I was there for a year, and there was snow. We had to tunnel our way out of the barracks to go to the latrine. And in the middle of the night, when it was snowing, we had to find our way out and go to the bathroom. So there were a lot of hardships that we had to endure.
Was there any water in the apartments?
No water in the barracks.
We do have a winner on the call that wants to speak with you, Margaret. Her name's Kathy. She's in Pismo Beach, and I'm going to bring her in to ask you a question.
Okay.
Hi, Kathy. You're on air.
Oh, thank you very much. Can you hear me okay? I'm in my car.
Can you hear Kathy okay?
Not too well. I have hearing aids, but they don't always.
I just turned the volume.
Is this better?
Is you want to switch places with me?
Oh, yeah. Okay. What did you want to ask?
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Oh, good. I'm a big fan. I hate to bring up something when you're in the middle of telling us how difficult it was in the barracks and that you had to go outside to use latrine.
Yes.
But my question is, tell me more about the farmers in the area who were still in Arroyo Grande, who took care of the Japanese barns, and when the Japanese returned, gave the farms back to them, especially Hayashi's.
Oh, yes, I heard about. You know, I want to say that for every bad person that treated the Japanese badly, there was another person, like the Loomises, who took care of the Japanese property and paid the taxes. And when the Japanese were, after the war, they handed the keys back to their original owners. And so for every bad person that took advantage, there was always a good person that really helped the Japanese. So I want to mention that again. So anyway.
and maybe this might also help with Kathy's question, but what was your experience coming back from the camps? Were there neighbors that helped you back, or were you from the other side of that?
I want to say when we came back, it was kind of a contrast between that and the previous place we lived. After the camp, we were allowed to go to Minneapolis, Minnesota. And there were very few Japanese people. But the people that in the school, the Jim Bryan Junior High, treated me so well. They bent over backwards being kind to me. And I even won a war bond jingle that I had to recite over the radio. WCCO at the University of Minnesota found my way there on a streetcar. But anyway, people there in Minnesota were very kind to me. And when I came back to California, it was just the opposite, because I went to, I was a sophomore in high school, and I saw some of my friends from before the war, and I recognized them, but they wouldn't recognize me. They pretended like they never knew me. So that hurt. Although there was one girl, Spanish-American girl, Trini Calvo, whose father came from Spain, and she remained my friend, and that was lucky for me, because otherwise I would not have anybody to have lunch with, and, you know, that was a very crucial part of my childhood, but she was a very loyal friend, so I was very lucky for that.
I would like to go back to what you said about in Minnesota about the war bond.
Oh,
you
yeah.
entered the
yes.
You entered a competition.
Yeah.
To write a jingle for the war bond.
Right, but that was,
and then you won it.
Yeah.
You were the winner. How ironic!
Yes, it was ironic, because here I was incarcerated during the war, and yet I won the jingle for the war bond, 7th war bond drive. So, anyway, that's okay. Anything else?
Kathy, anything else?
Were there many Japanese farms that were rescued?
All of them.
Yeah.
All of them.
Yeah. Wait, are you sure about that?
And
every Japanese farm was rescued?
Rescued.
Yeah, we're
no,
talking
no,
about,
no. Oh,
yeah.
No, that was no, taken. No.
All of them were taken, but how
they
many were rescued?
They were all taken. Not very many.
No.
And my understanding is very few, but those we appreciate. Yeah.
And that's the part that's really the story, our Central Coast story, is that can we say all of the farms in in Central Coast, or is it just
no,
a few even
I wouldn't
even
say
here?
All of the farms, because there were many people who took advantage and bought these farms pennies on the dollar, and the original farmers lost a lot of money, and almost everybody lost something. My father lost his car because they were promised him a certain amount of money, and when it time came to turn it over, he got just a fraction. So, that was probably a more typical situation there.
I think our Jim Gregory, the historian, says in his video that most of the farmers did not come back to Arroyo Grande after the war and pick up their farms.
Just a few of them did. Let's take a quick moment to just tell people how they can see Behind Barbed Wire, if that's all right.
Yes, you can see Behind Barbed Wire Redux, and it will be performed at the Clark Center in Arroyo Grande on January 23rd, 2026 at 7:30 p.m. You're able to find more information and purchase your tickets at clarkcenter.org/shows/behind-barbed-wire.
Or you can call the box office right now at 805-489-9444.
Again, that's 805-489-9444. And Kathy, again, you won your ticket to see Barbed Wire Redux. We have your phone number, and we can contact you with more details about that.
Well, I'm just delighted, and it's so good to hear your firsthand story. They're so heartrending, but it's something we need to know. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy.
Thanks, Kathy. Going back to your story, Margaret, I wanted to ask, what was it like when you were in the camps with your peers? What was some of that?
Well,
what was happening in those conversations?
You know, I didn't have too many friends. In camp, I was 11 and 12. But we were sort of drawn away from anybody we ever knew. My grandfather lived on the other side of the camp, but I still remember my address. I lived in 95B, Heart Mountain, Wyoming, at the camp, and that was Block 9, Barracks 9, and Room B. Now, these rooms barely had enough room for all five in our family. And, we had to kind of walk around the beds in order to get around. So it was not very pleasant to stay in the room. Most of the time we were, outside playing. But we did have one good thing. Every once in a while, in a barracks that there was sort of a movie studio, they showed Flash Gordon movies, and I remember seeing those Flash Gordon movies. And every time I see a comic book or something that says Flash Gordon, it reminds me of the camp. So, we tried to make our lives good, and the government didn't try to make our lives bad, because they fed us. And, the only thing is we had nothing to do. And the older people were trying to figure out what to do. So they made little ornaments and lapel pins out of peach pits and something out of the plastic from the toothbrushes and tried to keep themselves busy. I took piano lessons for free from a man that played the piano, so I did that for a while. So trying to make our lives as enjoyable as possible was what we did.
And Margaret, you said you learned how to do, it was like a, I don't know the
dance.
It was a tune?
The jitterbug.
The jitterbug, a dance.
Yeah, I learned a jitterbug, and I think these mostly young men sent for their instruments, and near the end of my incarceration, they built a high school with a really big gym, and I learned a jitterbug there, and that was a very good thing. I can't say the The camp experience was all bad.
Did they have a big band with the youth?
They had the Glenn Miller type songs.
With the students, with their own instruments.
Right, but they were very, I thought they were very good. I didn't think they sounded amateurish at all.
I'm Dr. Mario Espinoza Kulik with you for Central Coast Voices on KCVX, Central Coast Public Radio, your listener-supported radio station. If you recently joined us for today's Central Coast Voices and want to listen to the entire broadcast, you can. It'll be available on our website at www.kcvx.org under the On Demand tab. Click on Central Coast Voices and you'll find this show and many others to choose from. You can also find this episode and all our past shows by searching Central Coast Voices wherever you get your podcasts. Behind Barbed Wire Redux will be performed at the Clark Center in Arroyo Grande on January 23rd, 2026 at 7:30 p.m. You can find more information and purchase tickets online at clarkcenter.org/shows/behindbarbedwire or calling the box office right now at 805-489-9444. Returning to our guests, we have with us today Dr. Dion Nielsen-Price, composer, pianist, author, and Arroyo Grande resident, Margaret Nakamura Cooper, retired Rigetti High School teacher in Santa Maria, and Dr. Brian Asher Al-Hadef, general and artistic director of Opera San Luis Obispo. And so we've been talking a lot about your experience, Margaret, at the incarceration camp and barbed wire, but there's still something that I wanted to make sure that we touch on, and that was what was behind barbed wire, the redux. And so what I kind of gathered was that in the way that this performance is composed, there's this sort of joyful tenor to it, despite the painful subject matter. And I had a question of what is the role that joy plays in the music and in the storytelling process? And I'm hearing a lot of joy in the pastime that, there's not a lot to do, but you had to make the best of it with your peers and with your elders and just the people who were your support system at the time. But from the composing side, I'm really interested in what's behind the joy or what's behind the story.
Well, maybe I'll kick that off by describing visually for our listeners what is behind Barbed Wire the show. So imagine coming into the beautiful 620-seat Clark Theater. The curtain's down. When that curtain raises, you'll see a traditional classical orchestra on half of the stage. Then you see this traditional 1940s big band raised, three levels of 1940s Glenn Miller style band with the music stand that come up in front of you, how you've seen in the old movies. And then behind all of this is a large movie screen that comes down, and there's a podium where narration occurs. And there's different kinds of narration. Our composer, Dion, she narrates part of the story. We have survivor stories that take place. Margaret, are you going to be one of our stories in the show?
Yes.
So Margaret will be featured in the production as well. And there's this interplay between video, historic video footage, narration from survivors and historians, and then there's the I like to call it the soundtrack of the time, which is represented by the big band. And then there's the reality of the emotion of the time, which is represented by Dion's composition and played by members of the Opera San Luis Obispo Grand Orchestra. And then that part of the so if you think about the big band, Catherine Loomis, the mezzo, she sings some big band songs, but there's also soloists, there's trombone solos, there's trumpet solos, piano solos.
Then we have Eric McConnell, baritone, is going to be sing.
I'm just going to get to that.
Yeah.
Then on the other side of the stage, we have Dion's music features soloist by the baritone, as you were mentioning, Eric McConnell, who many will remember played the role of Gaston in our 2024 right. grand production of Beauty and the Beast. That was his opera slow debut. Also is Chika Inoue. And she is a very fine internationally acclaimed concert saxophonist. And Dion, who you don't really – she keeps this a secret all the time. She's a concert pianist herself. And she had quite a career as a professor at USC teaching piano accompaniment. And right?
That's where I got my doctorate there. there, yes. Yeah.
And so she is actually going to be the concert pianist this year as part of the production.
Right.
So I'm really excited about that.
So I have to go home and practice
yeah.
now.
Yes, you do.
I would like to just say the underlying attitude of this show from a composer's viewpoint is to honor the integrity of these people, because there is sadness, but there's joy, and they saw it through. And I think Jim Gregory's video, which we will see, brings that out a lot, mm-hmm. and I appreciate that so much. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to hear you tell us, just before we end, about your school. You went to school on the camp.
Oh, yes. When we first went to camp, there were no regular schools. We were just schools in a barrack. And so they did the best they could. I don't know if they got credentialed teachers, but I missed out on algebra. So when I went out of the camp, I had lost this ability to do algebra. And besides that, I was nearsighted, so I couldn't see the board. And the teacher noticed I was nearsighted. So the Minneapolis school system was such that they let me go to an optometrist, and they fitted me for glasses, and then I could suddenly see all the leaves on the tree and the cigarette butts on the sidewalk. But I thought the Minneapolis schools were great. And I lived on 3925 Harriet Avenue near Lake Harriet. And I learned to swim there because the junior high school said that everybody who was in the junior high school had to at least be able to swim back and forth once in the pool. So that was a very good thing for me, because I now, at age 95, am able to swim 1,000 yards on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and that's one of my good exercises that I like to do.
That's good.
That's amazing.
When you were in the camp, did you have desks at school?
Did I have
When you went to school in the camp, did you have a desk?
No desks. No desks.
What
no.
How did you sit?
Well, there were benches. I mean, this was the very beginning. It was only at the end, when they did build the school, that then they had desks. Then they had desks. But that was I only was there a few months, because by then we had to leave. But, you know, I lost my brother. He was 11 years old, and he died in camp. And that was the saddest thing that happened to me in camp. So my mother saved his ashes and went, brought them back with her to California. And when my father died, she put some of his ashes in my father's jacket pocket, and he was buried with my father. So that was a sad thing. So people were born and died in camp, just as they would in regular life. So my mother suffered, but she never got bitter about the fact that her son had died in camp. And she could have been very bitter, but she said maybe he would have died anyway had we not been in camp. But he got spinal meningitis, which often is prevalent among people who live in close quarters. And so I just am so admiring of her ability to go through this period of sadness.
Margaret, thank you so much for revisiting those memories with us and sharing with our guests your experiences. And I mean, I don't think that this production would be the same without your narrative in it.
Absolutely. Thank you.
We do have only about two more minutes left with a time today. So I just want to before I ask a question, anyone else, do you have any parting words you'd like to say to our listeners today? And there's a lot of people searching for hope out there, I know for
sure.
Well,
I'd like to say, I hope our country has learned from this sad experience in World War II to not repeat this situation again, because this could happen again. We often don't learn from experience, but I would like to remind people that freedom is a very precious thing. And even though we had happy times jitterbugging, still being imprisoned is not a fun thing. And even though we were not treated badly, just losing your freedom is a very bad thing, and I don't want it to ever happen again.
I really appreciate you attending today. Thanks, Margaret. It was great to meet you. Dr. Dion, Dr. Brian, with the last minute that we have, any last words or anything you hope that our audience members carry with them after experiencing the commemoration?
My hope is that if you are a resident here on the Central Coast, this is your story. And just as history, it's so relevant. It's a horror story, but it's also a story of hope and celebration as well. We're one of the few places in the United States that actually has somewhat of a happy ending to this story.
Yeah.
And I really encourage everyone to experience this Friday, January 23rd, 7:30 p.m. at the Clark Center.
Dr. Dion.
My hope is that here in this area, it is not happening again.
Thank you.
And I also say that, even though we admitted we did wrong during World War II, and we even gave reparation to those who are still living, still no amount of money can replace loss of freedom. And I want people to remember that and not do this to any other people just because of their race, just because of their inheritance. And I'm very happy that we are having this program to inform people that this is a warning, and this is something that I'm happy to talk about.
Thank you so much for those words and for joining us today, everyone. We hope that you'll tune in next time for Central Coast Voices on Thursday, January 15th at 1 p.m. with host Fred Monroe and his guest from Restorative Partners. Central Coast Voices is co-produced to the show's host in collaboration with KCBX. We depend on folks like you to continue these programs. Please donate today or become a member with your monthly donation online at kcbx.org. I'm your host, Dr. Mario Spinoza-Kulik. Thank you for joining us.